Welcome to today's compiler construction, now by popular demand also amplified so that the last row can also understand. We have left off in the middle of introducing the basics for the parser phase of the syntactic analysis. So here we are now that we know what context-free grammars are. We now push forward into basics of pushdown automata. So let's have a look at what that actually is. You might remember some basic information about that from theoretical computer science. They're particularly handy since they are the direct equivalent in terms of semantics to what the context-free languages, context-free grammars could express. So that is kind of the natural principle to choose in a similar way as we had the finite automata corresponding to the finite languages and the regular expressions. So push-down automata, the most famous example may be this, the example of matching brackets, if you remember your theoretical computer science. So that was kind of a motivating example, and since you can imagine in computer languages there also are a lot of these structures that are introduced with a particular symbol or keyword and closed with a corresponding symbol keyword that already kind of has a scent of familiarity and of being a good choice for an implementation model. So maybe an example, because I think the version that we present here might be a little bit different to what you have heard so far, and also to collect people from other universities. Let's have a look at what we consider to be a pushdown automaton. So in the automaton we have states. We enumerate them as we have done in finite automata. 0, 1, 2 in this case. We have the concept of start states and final states. So in our case, 0 is a start state, and final states are in our case 0 and 2. And then there's the transition function. So that's what you see sketched over here in the table. And this has three components. The first component is the component that refers to what is found on the top of the current pushdown. And then there's the second component, which refers to what is found on the input. And then the third component is what is left on the top of the pushdown instead of the thing that we have matched in the beginning with. So that is how we have to read this transition relation.
One more time, what's the last box?
So we define in the first box what we find initially on the top of the pushdown. We take that away, compute, in the sense that we look at what is in the input, and then the last component says what we put on top of the of the pushdown instead of what we have found before. So we replace the top of the stack in the form of 0, replaced by 1 in that case. So that would be how to read that. So what we particularly have in our cases here, because we don't need that, is we do not differentiate between pushdown symbols and states. That is a thing that you might have or might be used to from a few other models, but in our case we do not differentiate between them. Instead instead of just having 0 and 1 as viable symbols on the pushdown, we have the state identifiers, and what we don't have is a kind of a state network, so to say, that we used to have maybe in our introductory example, but it's still, you can find mappings between those two models, so this is still a valid model for pushdown automata. Instead, the uppermost symbol of the pushdown is kind of the representative for the state of the machine in our model, and also every transition in our system is supposed to modify or consume the upper part of the push down, and maybe also push something new on there. So yeah, that is the kind of framework for our push down automata in there. A little bit more formally, push down automata. Well, there's the famous heads for that too. That's Friedrich Bauer, who might ring a bell for people who have studied here, and Klaus Samuelsson. And yeah, pushdown automaton is same as the finite automaton, definable by its components. So let's have a look at what we get by pushdown automata. So first of all, we are given a set of states, or pushdown symbols in our case. That's same thing. Then we have the alphabet of input symbols. That's what is found on, on the input. Then we have the start state Q0, which with which we start lying on the stack. And then there's a set of finite states with which we, well, if we find them on the stack being the only symbols left, then we would accept. So, yeah, the only thing that's still missing there is this delta, which we have also talked about a little bit earlier, which was the transitions in the pushdown automaton that consist of a left-hand side component being a string of states, in the middle a symbol to be consumed, maybe also epsilon, and on the right-hand side another string of states, maybe also no state at all, so also the empty string is possible. So that would be the definition for the pushdown automaton in our example. So if you think back to the finite automata, we had a concept of computations of automata, and that is what we also have for pushdown automata. So what is a computation in that context? So a computation would be the transition from one computational state into another. And computational state is a thing that we also call the configuration of a machine. And we would consider a tuple to be such a configuration, with the two components being the current context, the current content of the pushdown, as well as the remaining input. So it's gamma and W. So in our example, back to what we have seen in the introductory slide, that was the concrete instantiation of such a pushdown automaton. Let's have a look at how such a system is supposed to actually compute on an example input. Therefore, let's start with an initial configuration. For the for a valid configuration, we need a pushdown content as well as an input. That's what we get here. Zero is our start state, so that is supposed to be the initial content of the pushdown. And in terms of input, we can choose whatever we'd like to try for the automaton to accept. And let's see what it does for that particular input. So let's have a look. And let's see. So the transitions are given in this format of what we expect on the input, what on the push down, what we expect on the input, and what we put on the push down. So we have to check for the first two components of the thing to be present. So if those two things are given, then we might produce the thing from that particular column. So let's check what we find in the input and on the push down. So on the push down, there's 0, and on the input there's an A as the first symbol. So let's check. Well, luckily, already in the first line we find a matching transition. So 0 is the top of the push down, A is at the start of the input. So what we will do is we will consume the input. That is implicitly done each time that we find a matching transition. And we replace what we have matched with on the push down with what we find in the red column. So that's what we're going to do. Getting ourselves into the configuration 1-1 and the rest of the input with the initial A missing. So with that, we continue on. We try to match. So first of all, we try to match the top of the stack, and we see we can narrow it down to two possibilities, which would be these two. Both of them would match. So we still have to check for the input symbol, and luckily this one decides what the transition should be that should be performed in that case. So we will do that. We replace the 1 with 1-1 and consume an A, leading to this guy over here. And well, since this is almost the same as we had before, we can already check this line here, and again we find the same match and perform the same rewriting step. Well, not rewriting, just computing step. And now we have a slightly more interesting situation. It's not directly the same as before, in the sense that although we still have a 1 as the top of the stack, we now have B as the remaining input. So this one will not match anymore, because it's just for input of A. So we have to match this 1-1, which will be this match over here, 1-1 and B, that fits. And well, the action that's going to take place is we will replace 1-1 with 2. So pop 2 times the stack and push another 2 on there, while remove another one of the B's. And yeah, with that we have 2 as the top of the stack. Don't find it 2 in there. Let's look for 1-2. 1-2 can be found together with B. Well, that fits our needs perfectly. So we go with this one over here, leading to that situation, which is just the same as we had before. And we again do the same thing and end up with 2 and the empty input. The empty input, well, there's nothing to do anymore. So the only thing that we can hope for is that we have now reached the final state in the push down. And oh, happy day. 2 is in the final states, and with that we see that the input was accepted for our pushdown automaton.
Yes, I'm slightly confused. So stack contains the states, or should stack be empty? Should be empty other
computation? In our mo-
like another thing, a state is another thing.
Yes, so that is kind of the particularity in our model. We don't separate states and stack in any way, but we keep the states on the pushed down. Well, you could imagine that there's a logic that we just don't show that performs the push down stores, which would in another model just be these binary strings, in a way that it does it that way. So that's still.
So after the computation, stack should have one item in one state, or is it allowed to have multiple states?
The computation in our model would be terminated successfully with accepting a state when the only state that remains on the push down is one of the final states. But you shouldn't consider that to be so much of a real restriction, as you could always imagine transitions to be there in the case that your configuration looks like empty string. You have your accepting state somewhere in the end and some other states over here, where the transition would always match with arbitrary symbol 2. You could just enumerate each of the combinations that you have there and replace them with just the 2. And you could iteratively just collapse the complete push down such that only the final state remains. So it's not a very severe restriction in that sense. Good. So you could also remove it and just say, well, we terminate with the empty input string and a final state on top of the push down. That will also suffice, probably. Yeah. Good. So.
This is DFA, right?
This is? Is it? I have not yet really seen particular statements on that. So, as long as I don't say, I would not assume that that's deterministic. And yeah, it's not. But we'll see. Okay, so a computation step in our model is just a tuple of configurations, but not an arbitrary tuple, but a tuple that has certain properties. Particularly, you have the same prefix of the pushdown, and the suffixes that are here named with this gamma and gamma prime are the ones that need to be in the two outermost components of the any transition of the transition relation here. So need to be there here as gamma and gamma prime. And the transition which they are found, the input symbol that is carried with that particular transition is the one that is meant to be removed from the input, so matched against and then removed from the remaining input in the configurations. If that is the case, then this is a valid computation step of our machine model. So, again, pretty similar to what we have had for the other automaton. The computation relation here now depends, of course, on the transition relation of the actual pushdown automaton. So, in principle, we would have different computational steps for different pushdown automata, but for purposes of having more clear or more clean slides, and since we mostly have only one particular automaton definition active at that particular region of the slides, we just leave them away. But in principle, the relation would be dependent on the automaton. You can of course, also set up the reflexive and transitive closure of this, leading to a complete chain of steps of computations. But I think that's not too surprising. So with all that together, we can now talk about the semantics of a pushdown automaton in terms of sets of words. And, well, what you expect is, well, you start... No. If you start your automaton on a particular word and go arbitrary computation steps and reach a state where the input is completely consumed and there's only final state left on the pushdown, then this word with which you started the computation is considered to be a word that contributes to the semantics of that machine, or the set of words that are accepted by the machine. That's how it's defined. So, yeah, that was the thing with the empty input. Then, your question with determinism and non-determinism. So far, we didn't say anything on that. The crucial thing is that for a deterministic pushdown automaton, you need computations to be reliable in the sense that each time you start a computation, it will run into the same result, which means that the configuration is allowed to have maximally one successful configuration. Otherwise, the whole thing would not be deterministic. You could choose separate ways, which would run maybe in different which would result in different, accept or not accepting answers. So that's that. So, when is that the case? Well, that depends on the way that the transition relation is built up. So there can be, you have to look at all the pairs of transitions that there are, and there's a few that might be critical for the whole automaton to work in a deterministic or non-deterministic way, particularly if you find a pair of transitions for which you can say that the part that that matches with the top of the stack is somehow interfering with the other one. And with interfering, I mean that one of these components would be a suffix of the other one. In these cases, they would overlap, and both of them could be applied in the same situation, meaning in the same configuration of the pushdown. And if that is the case, if there is such a suffix relation between them, then you need some other way of disambiguation between those two, and the only thing with which you can disambiguate then would be the consumed input. So X and X prime are then the relevant things. So for a deterministic automaton, if such a Y1 would be a suffix of a Y1 prime, then you would need the input symbol to be actually different, and also, none of them would be allowed to be epsilon before epsilon would match in all cases, and even if the other one would have a different consumed input symbol, then still the epsilon symbol could be matched for that particular situation, and you would still run into two different computation steps being viable at that situation. And yeah, so that is a thing that needs to be not possible in our transition relation for the automaton to be non-deterministic. For the automaton to be deterministic. That's it. Okay, good. So, in our example, is there a standard deterministic or non-deterministic automaton? Well, let's check. We can do so by looking at the left-hand side parts of the transition relation and see whether they are in some way suffixing any other left-hand side part. And you see, well, there actually is such a situation. We have the second transition being the suffix of the third transition's left-hand side component. So in order for the transition relation to be one of a deterministic pushdown automaton, we now need the input symbol to be different, and well, yeah, that's the case here. We have an A and a B, so we can disambiguate with those, and we are fine. This transition relation is one of a deterministic automaton, so that's fine. Good. So the with respect to the relation between context-free grammars and pushdown automata, there's famous theorem by Schützenberg and Oettinger, where the main statement is that for each context-free grammar, that's the definition that we had, we can build a pushdown automaton such that the semantics of both of them are actually the same. So there is a correspondence between context-free grammars and pushdown automata. And that is kind of the key technique in the syntactical analysis of things, particularly a concrete constructive algorithm that that computes for a given context-free grammar a pushdown automaton with the same semantics as the context-free grammar had. When we end up with an algorithm that does that, then we have found the whatever we need as engine for our generator. And particularly we will look at several approaches to do that, motivated by a special thing that we have talked about yesterday, which would be these special derivations, particularly this leftmost derivation, which would be this thing that would enumerate as the nodes of such a derivation tree, the same way as a top-down, leftmost descending algorithm would give us, or the other one would be the reverse rightmost derivation. Just another reminder, that was the thing that would correspond to an enumeration of these nodes by a bottom-up run through the tree. So, yeah, these are the two general concepts, and they also kind of reflect this top-down or bottom-up behavior in the way that we consider our syntax to be or our syntax trees to be reconstructed out of that particular input. Just out of curiosity, do you remember how to come up with a syntax for a context-free grammar and some input in general? Is there something you remember from your past lectures? This ring a bell? Okay, so there was at least there has been years where there has been the I think Kukyanga Kasani approach was called, wasn't like that. So it was a kind of a brute force attempt in trying to bottom up reconstruct syntax tree in a non-deterministic way and by just brute forcing all the combinations that there would be until you reach the root symbol. No? Oh well, then never mind. I have the answer for you now. Yeah, well, in case that you might still have a few fragments of this thing flying around, this was a quite expensive algorithm, non-deterministic in its behavior, and well, in every respect, just a brute force algorithm with a quite hefty runtime cost, so to say. So that is an algorithm that works. You can compute your syntax tree with that algorithm, but that's a thing that you would never want to pay with your CPU time in kind of minute-based call, so to say. So that's it's just too expensive to be of practical use. Still, for theoretical purposes, this sufficed for finding an algorithm that would do that, but anyway, we will concentrate on particular algorithms in the first part on the one for top-down parsing. So for top-down parsing, there's the idea of the so-called item pushdown automaton. This is the one that would try to simulate a leftmost derivation by going top down the derivation tree, starting from the root symbol and trying to come up with a syntax tree and step by step verifying with the input by matching whether the input fits together with the leaves of the derivation tree until the algorithm has consumed the complete input, thus found the derivation tree that is matching for that input. So the key component of the item pushdown automaton is the one that reconstructs a leftmost derivation of a particular grammar and an input. So the key operation in this automaton would be expansion of a non-terminal using a rule. Expansion is the term for this rewriting process in the derivation. But expansion is the thing that is used in context of this item pushdown automaton. But it's in principle the same operation. If you expand a non-terminal, what you do is you rewrite the left-hand side symbol with one of the alternatives for its right-hand sides. So that's what is given here. So we do reconstruct by expanding non-terminals, and then what we do is we verify successively that the chosen rule actually matches the input. For that purpose, we want to use an item pushdown automaton. So we must think in terms of pushdown, which means that we must think of particular states that we want to manage on the pushdown while performing certain consummations on the input or transitions without any consummation for just managing rewriting stuff on the pushdown according to certain rules. So, yeah. If you think back to this, to performing these leftmost derivations, what you did was you would replace certain parts of the of right hand side of string of non-terminals, but you would for each of these replacements you would be able to pinpoint the precision with within a particular right hand side of a grammar you would replace according to a particular rule. So what you would keep in mind while doing these rewriting steps or expansion steps would be what you have already achieved so far. And if you do such a leftmost derivation, you always do a right thing until you consume something from the input, and then you backtrack and go the next thing after the branch that you have then already processed until you run out of non-terminals, and then you backtrack once and continue there with everything we have not touched here that yet. So what you need to remember during your path through descending the derivation tree is the kind of work that you have started to do but not yet finished, and the part of work maybe also an indicator for what you have already done in a particular subtree of a derivation tree. And for that, the idea would be to make use of the actual push down, in the sense that you would push states that would be somehow associated with the amount of work that you have already done while descending into your derivation tree. And what is actually suited for that is to think of states not in pure numbers, but give them actual more more telling names, in the sense that we consider items now not being just pure numbers, but instead being helpful in the way that their name actually gives us a clue about where what we have done in our derivation so far, and where we consider ourselves to be in terms of what we have processed so far and what we still have to do in deriving things. So what we would use for these kind of more helpful states would be to go over to so-called items. An item is an entity that consists of a rule, like this one, A goes to alpha and beta, and a marker, a so-called bullet, that tells us about which part of the right-hand side we already have processed during a derivation reconstruction, and which part we assume to still need to be matched with the input during this thing. So, very similar to the way that we have done this Berisetti automaton. There was also this marker that would tell us about what still needs to be done and what has already been done. But here it's on this derivation thing. So, yeah. Bullet marks the spot how far the rule is already processed. So, in an example here, we have the grammar S goes to AB, A goes to small a, and B goes to small b. This is a very simple example. There's only one derivation tree, and this would match the input string AB. So let's have just a small look to reassure that we have understood well what this bullet actually means. So we would start our reconstruction of the derivation. Derivation would be running through this this syntax tree in a certain order, particularly in this case the leftmost derivation would just match with the left branches before it goes over to the right branches. So in the beginning we would consider to have not derived anything, so the bullet marker would say we have processed nothing of the right hand side of this SAB. Instead, we expect AB still to be used for for expansion. So particularly A needs to be expanded. This will lead to this small a. So this small a would then be the next symbol, the next item on the pushdown, while this one would still remain there. And then we find that this small a is already a terminal, and this is considered to be used for expansion next. Well, expansion cannot happen anymore, but what can still happen is matching with the input. So this is what's actually been will be done. So we will replace this thing that we have had on the push down with a version where the marker is now on the right hand side, meaning this A has matched. We also remove small a from the input and continue with computation. So here the bullet is on the right hand side. We can't. We don't expect anything for this item to match anymore, so we can also just remove that from the stack. So that's what we will do. We will remove that, go away, and now that we have seen, well, we have now had a complete derivation for a large A, we will replace the item that we have still lying around on our stack, that would still assume that A had to be expanded, by another item where we say, well, A has been expanded now, we now need to continue with B, thus tracking our progress in doing the derivation and matching the input. So with that, we would then see, well, with large B, we cannot match anything more, but we can expand B. So we do that and expect the right-hand side of the expanded thing to then match next. And, well, this is a lowercase b, which we also find the input. So remove it from input and move the marker to the right, leading to the item being replaced with this one. And, well, since this is already finished, it's a closed item, so we say, we can just remove that and move, well, this is not what has been there, this one was there. We will replace the item from above with that item, where the marker is now at the end, meaning this is also closed. And with that, we have consumed the complete input. We have emptied the pushdown, but for just one remaining item, which is then also just one where the bullet marker is at the very end, which is a closed item, which is a good thing, because this one is done with deriving. There's nothing that we need to match it with anymore, which could be a hint for a final state, for example. So that would be an idea of coming up with a pushdown automaton that can match the input. And yeah, so let's try to do that. Well, there's the animation for this on your slides also. So there you go. Yeah, at some point we do that. That is always when we find that the marker is in front of a non-terminal. Since with a non-terminal we cannot really remove anything from the input, we need further information what this particular thing actually is. So we need to expand. And this expansion thing would consist of, well, I leave my current piece of work and start a new one, which means I need to still remember where I have been, which is
the idea of this push-down thing, pushing my work further back and open a new one. So push a new thing like this, capital A goes to small a, mm-hmm. and yeah, that's your push. Yeah. Yeah, well, this is, I don't know whether that is a good, it's not the same action that happens here. There's no thing pushed again on the stack in that sense, but yeah, that's why I use different colors here, but probably I should remove the line between them, because it's not a push action that happens there anymore. It's more or less like a comparison with the input. Maybe the next page renders more clearly, although there's more formulas on there. So, well, formulas in this are actually supposed to make things more clear. So, yeah, don't be afraid of them. They are helping you. So, for purposes that I don't want to state beforehand, what we do is we will add another rule to make things more explicit, particularly the starting symbol. So I add such an S prime and map to the symbol that is considered to be the root symbol of the actual grammar, and then such a dollar sign as kind of a fresh symbol that hasn't been there before, which kind of signifies something like end of input stream or whatever you'd like it to be. This is there for getting rid of, for example, grammars where the root symbol already has several alternatives of producing right-hand side or expanding to right-hand sides, and I want to have one clear end state in for my purposes here. So that's why I introduced this artificial one, and this has only one alternative, so there's one clear start state and one clear end state that I can talk about, and there's no confusion. So it's a technical thing, doesn't have any particular reason then to make things a little bit more compact, in the sense that we have one particular end state, one particular start state. Good. So in that system, how do our transitions actually look like now, not with numbers but with these kind of helper structures? So the first one I will leave out, we can talk about that a little bit later on. That is kind of the initial state that we had also on the animation on the page before. So that is the item that is motivated by this S goes to AB, which is coming from the former root symbol, and the bullet is on the very left hand side, meaning that this is still to be derived. And what we then do is we don't consume anything, but we will build up our pushdown by pushing another new item on there. The old one still remains there, it's still this bullet AB, so we don't consider that our work to be done yet, because we still need to work on the new item over here. The item that spawns here is motivated by the non-terminal that the marker is in front of. So the marker is in front of a large A, so we check for an expansion valid for capital A, and this goes to small a, but we still need to match with that. The actual matching, that was the part in the animation that was maybe a little bit confusing, is this one where the marker is in front of a small a, and the marker moves behind this small a, and it does so by consuming an a. So that is the actual thing that is supposed to happen in the automaton. So we do a consummation of the input
while rewriting our topmost item in a way that the A is now consumed, and that is reflected in the bullet moving to the right hand side of the small A. So with that being done, we can now have a look at a situation where there is something below an A goes to A bullet, particularly this would be that item. And yeah, we said that in case that we have completed an item in the sense that the marker is now on the right hand side, we said that we could then remove it from the push down because we have successfully matched it with the input and need to continue with whatever we have left behind on the push down. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to continue with the situation from before, but we now have successfully matched something for the subtree that belongs to large A. So this doesn't need to be derived anymore. So we can move the bullet one to the right and continue with matching something for B. And in the same way, we continue. We will have a look at that item where the bullet marker is in front of another non-terminal. And what we do is we push another temporary item on there where the bullet is in front, in the very front now. And well, this is coming from an expansion of a B, which was marked in the item below. In case that we find a B in the input and topmost symbol a marker in front of a B, we rewrite that and consume a B. And in the same way as before, if we close an item, we can remove it from the stack and move the underlying bullet one to the right, which will, in that case, for example, also create a completed item, which will lead to that thing being removed and only the artificial initial state being left. And yeah, well, these are just there because we added the artificial thing, but that's not adding anything in particular. That still keeps the same rule set. There's a bullet in front of an S, so we expand with the S production, and here the thing is closed, so we move this thing. And that is now a final state. So far, seems valid. So this is a thing that has already shown you the basic principles in what we are gonna do in terms of item pushdown automata. So there has been three kinds of transitions that we would introduce for such item automata, particularly the ones where we find that we still need to perform derivation steps. That would be the expansions, which would stop working on the current item and push a new item on the push down. And formally defined, this means that in case that there is a rule that looks like having a large B somewhere on its right hand side, and another rule that tells about how to expand such a B. And if they all are actual rules in our set of productions, then, well, what we insert as expansion is of the following form. We write said production as the left-hand side of a thing, while where the marker is then on a non-terminal. We add it on the right-hand side also, but we don't forget to open up a new item for the expanded non-terminal. All the while, we don't consume anything on the input. This is still internal management of items. So that is just a general version of what we have seen before. And we do so for each occurrence of a non-terminal in a right-hand side of any production of our rule set. and any rule that that rewrites that particular non-terminal. So it's kind of spamming our table of transitions with such expansions, such that, well, whenever we have such a situation, we have the according transitions. In the same way, we spam our transition table also with another kind of transitions that we call shifts, which are the ones that are there for actually consuming the input. So we said that that would be necessary in case that we find but we find that there's right-hand sides of productions that actually have terminals. So each of the occurrences of terminals that we find, what we do is we add the production which we have found that with a marker in front of that particular terminal. And as the resulting top of pushdown, we add the same item but the marker shifted to the right by one while consuming an input of A. Spam our transitions with all the shifts that we can rationally build. Then we still need to define how to collapse our pushdown once again, and that's what we do with the reduces. So a reduced looks like that. We have a completed item on the top of the stack. So what and well, of course, that is a valid production of production set. And well, for each other production that has an occurrence of the left-hand side of the former thing, so this B needs to occur in there, we add such a reduce action such that the completed item is removed and the bullet is shifted by one, like this, contrary to the other one. So this also contributes in a large number of reduces. Particularly what we find is that we get as many expansions as we get reductions with that. In case that we need to set up such an automaton manually, don't know whenever you should do that, remember to count your expansions and add the same number of reduces to your transition table, so that you have matching pushing of new items with removing of closed items. And apart from that, you do as many shifts as there are occurrences of terminal symbols in right-hand sides. And yeah, that should do it. Okay? Good. So, complete items, we have already talked about. That's fine. So, all in all, what we get with that is that, well, we by construction here, we move the bullet from left to the right. Thus, we are establishing that we will always concentrate on leftmost symbols before we start expanding the righter ones. So, this will lead to leftmost derivation all in all. That's already quite nice. What also we can observe is that the expansions themselves, although the position where we expand is pre-given, well, there's several alternatives for particular non-terminals how to be rewritten or expanded. So, well, there's a certain degree of non-determinism still in this algorithm, which needs to be addressed a little bit later on. In order to prove that what we do here is in somewhat correct, we need to prove that the computation steps that are induced by that automaton are actually
contributing the same semantics as the original one of the context-free grammar, in the sense that whenever a particular symbol yields a particular string of terminals, then this needs to be consumed by the automaton in the computations between where the bullet is on the left-hand side of such a symbol and whenever it reaches the right-hand side of such a symbol. And with that, we can show that the construction actually is somewhat correct. Although we still don't do that here, you could do such a proof in principle at least. So that gives us a certain idea of how to approach the topic of parsing with an item pushdown automaton, although this non-determinism is still a thing that's buggering us a little bit. So we need to clarify how to get rid of the non-deterministic part of that. And that is what LL parsing is actually all about. This starts from the idea of an item pushdown automaton of that form and tries to come up with ways of making the non-deterministic choices in their deterministic. And there's several ideas of how to do that. Maybe let's look first at an example for a larger item pushdown automaton. And that's the automaton for that particular language over here. And you see, I said the position of where to expand in the item pushdown automaton was pre-given by shifting the bullet from left to right. That's still true. And I also said that there would be non-determinism somewhere in the automaton. In the example before, we didn't find any of that. But in this example here, we have such a thing. And in generally, these non-deterministic things are introduced by alternatives for right-hand side. As soon as you have choice whether to reduce, whether to expand with one alternative or the other, then you run into non-determinism. You can expand with any of those, and who guarantees you that you did the right choice in order to reach an input symbol somewhere nested deep down in your leaves that you reach at one point of expansion. So, this is reflected in the transition table. We can apply the test that we have had before for determining whether an automaton is deterministic or non-deterministic. And can you spot the non-determinism in the transition table of that thing? Yes?
3 and 4.
Why?
Because they both consume the same thing on the stack, and both consume epsilon.
So their consummation part is actually completely, literally the same, and their consummation of the input is even more non-deterministic by being just epsilon. So there's no disambiguation between those. We can arbitrarily choose which of those there are. Also, the other one is probably 0, 1. It's also the same input, and there's also epsilon in the consummation. So these are the critical parts in our automaton. Well, bugger that. What should we do? Well, there's several ideas of how to cope with that. Is there any ideas by anyone of you what you would do in that situation? Yes?
What do we do something like before when the previous X is empty?
So, I need to understand you
better. Like the
Yeah, that's already going in one of the directions of what we're going to see later on. Yeah, so we could consider kind of what is next to be consumed from the input in order to decide what there is. That's actually also the thing that we're going to see later on.
So it's not for nothing that we have talked about things like this first and next in the past already, but yeah, well, in general, there's several ideas which are kind of generic to automata and not really related too much to our particular thing. There, for example, is the idea of, well, if there's a non-determinism, well, what we should do then is probably just try all the possibilities that there are. Yeah, and there's simulations of non-deterministic automata with deterministic automata that will kind of, well, in each of the cases where you could do two decisions, you consider, well, then let's try out either of them in parallel. And at that point, you split your current computation state into two, and in each of these states, you continue with a different alternative. So there's one state continuing with the first branch and the other one with the second branch, for example. And you can even try to optimize such a approach a little bit more by kind of sharing the parts of the derivation tree that have been common so far and only start managing different states at the point where the split actually happened, for example. So that will lead into one possibility for dealing with that. Then there's also another idea to kind of, instead of invest in space in order to do that, you could invest in time in the sense that you would try to explore these solutions one after the other by just, well, trying to match with the input. In case that you didn't match, go back and retry another decision. If that also doesn't match, go even further back, do another decision, and in that sense, backtrack step by step. This might lead into a little bit of problem in areas where you get into recursive expansions, for example, which will lead to you needing to carry with you a certain limit of recursions that or a limit of depth that you want to explore before you actually say, well, with that depth I'm not gonna succeed anyway, let's increase it by one, for example. And this will lead into a lot of recomputations of things that you have already done, and yeah, it's kind of a waste of things, but yeah, that's another idea. So first of all, this GLL parsing, which would be this duplication of your computation state whenever there's alternatives in there, so that is a valid thing that's done. Then there's recursive descent and backtracking with a depth limiter in the case of recursive expansions, and then there's recursive descent and look ahead. So the idea of looking at the input before we do the actual matching and take the input as a hint for determining the decision that we will have to do at that point. So that is actually the idea of what LL parsing or general LL parsing is about. So the parser model is now looking like this. We have a pushdown where we still manage the items from the item pushdown automaton. We have an input which we can consume and where we can have a limited frame of input which we can check for advice on decisions that we need to take. Particularly for our purposes, we will limit this window to one token. So the parser accesses a token frame of length 1 of the input. In its logic, the parser also carries with itself a decision table M, which can be indexed by the current state Q that is taken from the push down, and the prefix of length 1 of the input, of the remaining input of course, as the second dimension, and it can look up what choice in terms of expansion the LL parser needs to do. With that, we get advice on how to expand correctly and hopefully resolve the non-determinism in our automaton. That looks fine, of course, but the question is still out there. Well, how do I relate input symbols to alternatives of my expansions for a certain non-terminal? That seems a little bit related, maybe, but not obvious how to relate those to each other. So, first of all, the question is any grammar actually suited for the approach that we have sketched so far? And well, not all, but there is a relevant subset of languages that is suited for that kind of parsing, which is called the set of LL1 grammars. And for those, if there's two alternatives for in the rules for expanding a particular non-terminal A, so if there's two alternatives in the rule set, then in every situation in which we need to actually decide what to expand, how does such a situation look like? Well, that would look like this over here, where the start symbol in some arbitrary number of steps of leftmost derivations, that's the little L, reaches a sentence fragment like this one, where we have a sequence of terminals U in the beginning, and then the non-terminal A, which would directly translate to A being the leftmost non-terminal that there is. So that is now we now need to expand A at that point. There's no more other symbol to the left available to expand, so we need to expand that. Well, what we need to establish is that first of alpha, which means the first symbol within the yield of whatever the right-hand side of alpha is, concatenated with whatever comes after this A. Why that? Well, that is what ends up being the suffix for the alpha in the end after the thing. And if this alpha is very short, then this B might be still relevant for this thing. If whatever is yielded by this alpha beta is distinct from the first symbol of whatever is yielded by alpha prime, which is the right-hand side of the other alternative, together with the right context of A, if the intersection is empty, then we have distinct terminals that determine which of the alternatives was the right choice to reach this particular terminal symbol. That's just, a definition which is made up for, or directly motivated by the algorithm that is this LL1 algorithm. It reads a little bit confusing, but it's just nailing the idea of the algorithm and calling grammar that is well suited for that algorithm to be an LL1 grammar. Yes?
Is that first thing in the definition referring to the first terminal? Or
that is, I didn't say that explicitly. So first of something is meant to be the first terminal in the yield of the sentence form that is in the brackets. We will see what first actually means a little bit later on after having a few motivational examples for that. So there's the example of what could be a fragment of computer language. So S, maybe a statement, expands to if and an expression, then statement else statement, or alternatively while expression and statement, or alternatively just an expression statement. While expressions in our case is a pretty simple thing, it's just identifier, but could be whatever. In our case, it's just identifier. So, is that now grammar that is LL1, meaning where each of the alternatives leads to different first symbols of the yield of whatever this alternative is? And for that we have to examine closer what the alternatives for each of these productions is. So let's have a look at this. The yield of this thing is of course highly variable, depends on whatever is expanded for S and S. But we don't need to look at the whole thing for LL1, but instead only look at the very first token of that thing. And we realize that in our case, this would be if, or maybe like this, this if, and that is already the first symbol for the first alternative. It's directly written there, so we don't need to think too much about the rest of this. So we don't care about how this is expanded. So for the first alternative, the first terminal is always if. Yeah, for the next alternative, we have a similar situation. In particular, the first terminal for this alternative will always be while. Since we're only interested in the first alternative anyway, and it's fixed while, that's good. So we have if while. Now, the third alternative is a little bit more complicated because the first terminal is not directly mentioned over here, but we see that there's no much messing around. We will always always expand E here, and in our particular version there's only identifier that can be expanded with, so this will always end up with ID as the first token. So for each of the alternatives we have a different first terminal, and this will already give us, well, with LL1 we can parse this, we can parse the language for this grammar. So, that's nice. Let's have a look at the next example. And you see the spoiler already at the bottom of the line, but might be interested in why that actually is the case.
So we have similar situations before, in that there's similar alternatives, but there's one added, which is the second one over here, which is just an if without the else dangling around. So what does that actually change? Well, the first symbol, if we determine that, is while and ID. So while the first, third, and fourth are the ones that we already are expecting, second one, well, is a direct match with the first one, which is a bad thing. So we cannot choose based on the first item on the first terminal of the input what we should choose. So the question is, does it help if we make our input window larger? And in our case, well, that would then hit opening brackets at that point. So if opening bracket will still not resolve the conflict. Well, for sure there will be some size of the input window that could help us. So let's go this way. Well, E is identifier in all the cases. So that's already 3. Then we have this one. 4, still not resolved, but well, then S will for sure help. Well, does it really? S will have either if, while, or E. And in the case that it is an if, well, we're still not sure which of the original things will be. And since this is a recursive thing, this will kind of be a never-ending chain of symbols that can be pumped into the non-terminal here, such that we never reach the point where we can actually disambiguate between those two alternatives. Only after an arbitrary number of symbols read. So for that, it's a pretty hard thing to actually come up with a fixed limit of window that we have to determine beforehand to cope with arbitrary language input. So yeah, that is an example for a language for which there is just no LLK parser at all. So that is a language that will. Or that is a grammar that is never gonna be parsable by our LL approach at all.
What does K
stand? K is the size of the look ahead window, meaning the number of terminals that I can use as a hint for deciding which of the alternatives I'm gonna take. So there will never be a finite constant that will be enough as a hint for which of the alternatives to take, is kind of the statement in this one here. Okay. So before we actually now start with the concrete definition of the first sets, I would say let's end it on this, because in 5 minutes we're not going to reach a nice recovery point. So let's keep it with that. And next time, is actually next Thursday bank holiday? Could that be the case?
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, it looks like that. Ah, and the next time is the 17th already. We will have a replacement speaker next time, because I'm not actually in town in 2 weeks. So, I think she will appreciate me leaving her with a complete and unbroken subpart of
the lecture, so she can start fresh with just introducing first one sets and how to compute them. And I think this will also be beneficial for you, especially with next week being Thursday without any event. So that will be it for today. So enjoy the rest of the festivities, and we'll see us either in the tutorial or, well, then in probably 3 weeks. Yeah, somewhat like that. So have a nice time, and goodbye.